The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is a very difficult portion, very difficult parsha. The theme of this portion begins with the words, Ki tetzei l'milchama aloivecha, when you will go to war against your enemies. And there are two ways of understanding the word ki. The word ki can mean when you go to war. It could mean if you go to war. Either of which is a challenging question. And the theme of this entire portion is the nature of warfare, how one fights a war, how does one deal with the yetzarim, the inclinations, the desires, the passions that are aroused in a war. There's a certain level of experience of reality that becomes so much more real and so much more felt and so much more experienced, really, than anything else I could possibly describe. It's the difference between the difference between being on a special date with a girl and being under your wedding chuppah, right, under your wedding canopy. It's not that under your wedding canopy it's a better date. It's just a whole different experience, you know? So what is war? How does war work? Why do we wage war? Those are really the questions, the themes of this week's portion. It's appropriate that this week is always one of the weeks of Elul, the month of Elul, 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, before the new year begins. And, of course, with what's going on in the world today, many of these questions, unfortunately, are still very practical. And I'll tell you, just by way of an example, an interesting story. I was once on Miluim. I was once on reserve duty, and had a very interesting experience. We were down sort of near the border with Egypt, and came across this Arab village. I'm not going to tell you exactly where we were or where this village is for safety reasons that I guess will become apparent. But I have this little game I used to play when I'd go on reserve duty. You know, whenever you see, especially an Arab village. So most of the Arab villages in Israel are actually 200, 300 years old. Some of them are older. And you kind of wonder, some of them are, thousands of years old. Like, what made the people who live in this particular village choose to begin the town in that particular spot? You know, what were the anthropological, the historical reasons? So sometimes, it's fairly obvious. You'll find a village and it's next to a river, or it's in a strategically placed location on top of a mountain, like the ancient city of Gamla. But I have to say that this particular Arab village had me completely stumped. It was in the middle of this wide-open, arid area, nothing but desert, no rivers, no mountains, no reason that anybody would want to live there. And I was curious. I was kind of like I was looking at the map, when I had a chance. I was trying to figure out, how did this Arab village get there? And the way that I actually found out was a most unexpected experience. Now, a few days into the reserve duty, that was the middle of the night, and we were on Jeep patrol, and we got a radio call from one of the checkpoints that a local Arab had come out to the checkpoint extremely agitated. And he was demanding to see someone in charge. And since we were patrolling, our whatever 5-10 kilometer stretch of road with a Bedouin tracker, because we were on the border with Egypt, there are a lot of Bedouin and Druze who serve in the Israeli army as trackers, and the stories about them are the stuff that legends are made of. Anyway, this particular Bedouin tracker happened to be the closest guy who was fluent in Arabic, so we drove over to see what the commotion was about. Turned out that this man's wife and daughter had not come home, and he wanted the army's help to find them. Now, normally the Israeli army is not in the business of helping local Arabs solve their domestic problems, but this case was a little bit different. Turns out that when the Israeli army pulled out of many of the Arab towns and villages as part of the Oslo Accords, there were a great many Arabs who had been helpful to the Israelis, either as, stinkerim, sort of like suppliers of intelligence, informants, or other forms of all sorts of gainful employment. It could be something as simple as that they supplied vegetables to the army base. And basically, when the Palestinian Authority took over a lot of these areas, any Arab who was deemed to be cooperating with Israelis was in tremendous danger. And occasionally you would hear stories about, men who were dragged out in the middle of the night and whatnot. So the Israelis, not wanting to leave these guys behind, basically set up villages overnight to accommodate these men and their families to situate them further away from other local Arab villages for their own protection. And these people lived in constant fear, fear for their lives, the lives of their families. I mean, they were caught between a rock and a hard place. The only way the army could ensure their safety was to set them up in their own separate villages. But of course, this marked them in the eyes of the rest of the Arab population as collaborators. And it made it nearly impossible for them to live, lead normal lives. In this case, this fellow saw some men that he did not recognize eyeing his home the previous day. And he was terrified now that something had occurred because his wife and daughter hadn't come home. And we figured out very quickly we were way out of our league. We called the main base. They eventually got whatever the GSS, the General Security Service is, who deal with like intelligence gathering operations, and they were called in to deal with it. And I was actually on patrol again the next day when they found their bodies. They had taken this woman and her daughter. They had chained them to a couple of tires, and they dumped them alongside the village the next day. And it took me a few weeks to erase the image from my mind. The girl couldn't have been more than 5 years old. And the obvious evidence of what had been done to them, I mean, it was just an education in the nature of the enemy that we were fighting, still are. It seemed, from the unavoidable look before you cover their bodies, it seemed that whoever did this must have enjoyed it. It was just a terrible experience. And I spent the next couple of weeks trying to erase the sight from my mind, as well as wondering how low a regard for human life these people could have, I mean, to have done such a thing. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, how glad I was that I was part of an army and part of a culture, even though, you know, the Israeli have had to fight a number of wars, that the perspective that we have on life and on how we relate to our enemies is a completely different perspective. All of which is what makes this week's portion a little bit challenging. Because there are a couple details in this week's portion, and we won't get to all of them, that really challenge this perception. Right? There is actually a specific commandment regarding the nation of Amalek. Okay, the Amalekites were the same nation that attacked the Jewish people just after they, the splitting of the sea, just after they, you know, their greatest miracle and their greatest moment, and seemed to go against the grain of everything Judaism stands for, because we're actually commanded, remember, you know, many years later, to destroy the nation of Amalek. V'haya baniach Hashem Elokecha lecha mikol oyvecha misaviv. When God will finally give you rest or respite from all your enemies round about, this means in the land of Israel, right? In the land that God gives you as an inheritance l'rishtah to conquer, timche et zecher Amalek mitachat hashamayim lo tishkach. You must erase the memory of the nation of Amalek from beneath the heavens. Do not forget. The Jewish people here are specifically commanded to wipe out an entire population. All the people of Amalek, including, it seems, men, women, children, everything. And this, it appears, even long after the memory of the original battle with Amalek itself may have faded. I mean, this mitzvah is actually not fulfilled until the time, or the attempt to fulfill this mitzvah doesn't occur until the time of King Saul, because you need a king to fulfill this mitzvah, which is in the times of the prophets of Samuel, and you're talking about 250 years later. That'd be like me coming to you and saying, listen, in the American Revolution, there was a neighborhood that did a terrible injustice to the Jewish people, so we should go now and wipe them out. I mean, that's a very difficult commandment, to say the least. Even assuming that we could come up for a justification for such a strangely cruel commandment, which seems to be so out of Jewish character, why would the children of this nation, long generations later, still be held accountable for the sins of their ancestors? Indeed, how could you hold an entire people accountable for the mistakes, the sins, the transgressions of men of a different generation? I mean, is this the ethical society we dreamed of bringing into the world? I mean, whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? So obviously a closer look at the story of Amalek is in order. Who is this nation that in Jewish lore has come to epitomize the very nature of evil incarnate? And what did they do that was so terrible that it seems that even God himself cannot, or at least will not, ever forgive them? Right? I mean, if Hashem tells us, if God tells us that this nation has to be entirely destroyed, then there must be something within the nature of this people that undermines the very fabric of society, perhaps precluding us from ever reaching the goal of peace and harmony among men in an ethical world. So what is this dangerous, this destructive ingredient that is so anathema to world society that we need to wipe out this nation? By the way, if the mission of the Jewish people is to be a light unto the nations, to create an ethical world, then if part of that mission, if a particular mitzvah, is that we have to destroy the nation of Amalek, it must mean that this nation in its entirety poses a threat to the possibility of our being a light unto the world, and of the world ever becoming the ethical place of light that it's meant to be. And by the way, this mitzvah, this commandment of Amalek, this is not some obscure theological or ethical principle. The Rambam, Maimonides, actually rules this as a halakha in the Laws of Kings, in Hilchos Melachim, in the 6th chapter and the 4th halakha, that we are still legally bound to this mitzvah today, although there is a divergence of opinion between Rashi and Maimonides as to whether we're also forbidden to make peace with them, or whether you could call to them to peace, and if an Amalekite would accept the 7 Noachad laws and become an ethical member of society, whether then the mitzvah wouldn't apply, which is Maimonides' opinion. But assuming that that doesn't happen, we're still bound by this today. Now, technically, just so nobody misunderstands this discussion, first of all, it's very hard to define who Amalek is today. It's not a simple question. And second of all, you cannot fulfill this mitzvah according to almost all the authorities unless you are in the land of Israel, and you have a king, and you have prophecy, and you have a temple, and you have a Sanhedrin, the high court. So I'm not saying that anybody should go out and, you know, start killing off Amalekites. Although it's interesting that there is one opinion, the Noda B'Yehuda of Yechezkel Landau, who actually has a very strange responsum, lived in you know, I think, don't hold me to this, I think the early 1700s, and claims that he was once walking down the street and saw an anti-Semite, and he recognized in him the simanim of Amalek. He knew with absolute certainty he was descendant of Amalek, and that he felt it was his responsibility to kill him. And what practically happened is another discussion, but in terms of the mitzvah that's involved, right? So how do you deal with this, right? How do you understand such a mitzvah? So in order to understand what's really at the root of this harsh commandment, you have to first see it in its full context, okay? Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek. Remember that which Amalek did to you. It's interesting, by the way, that it doesn't say Zachor et asher asa Amalek. Remember what Amalek did. Remember what Amalek did to you. Which must mean that Benny Friedman, living in the year 2006, right, 5765, I have to feel that what happened, you know, 3,000 years ago was done to me, right? And I have to remember this. So remember that what Amalek did to you, and feel that it was done to you, baderech, on the road, b'tzeitchem mimitzrayim, when you left Egypt, asher kolcha baderech, v'yizanev b'cha. Right? That Amalek, the word kolcha means that they happenstance to cross you. It's interesting that the Eish Kodesh, one of the last rabbis of the Warsaw Ghetto, who was murdered in Treblinka, and whose writings live on, very powerful stuff, actually comments on this. Asher kolcha baderech can come from the word mikre. They happen to cross you, as if to imply, don't look for a reason. There is no reason. This is hatred as its purest form, hatred for no reason. In fact, it was illogical for Amalek to do what it did, and nothing to gain by it. That's one opinion, and of course, if that's true, then Rav Soloveitchik suggests that Amalek represents any nation in the world today that wants to destroy the Jewish people simply because they're Jewish, even though they gain nothing from it, right? Which is an interesting question. And the other opinion which he suggests is asher kolcha, that he made you kar, he made you cold on the road. And he compares this to the experience in Germany, even though he doesn't mention them by name, but he's writing this in the ghetto. So he compares this to the experience in Germany where German culture made us cold to what in essentially is supposed to be the fire that warms our heart, right? We were made cold to Judaism in so many different ways. So whatever that experience is, it happened on the road, it happened for no reason, right? And we're meant to remember, right, this experience, right? So kol hanecha shalim acharecha, that Amalek, kolcha baderech v'yizanev b'cha, and they literally came to you as a tail from behind, kol hanecha shalim, all the weak acharecha who were behind you, v'ata ayef v'yageya, and you were tired and worn out, right? V'lo yare elokim, and you were not in awe or in fear of God. Now, the traditional commentary is that Amalek wanted to undermine the accomplishments of the Jewish people. you think about the world that had just experienced the splitting of the sea and the exodus from Egypt. There were no limits. The world had just discovered that there was a new force to be reckoned with. God had just performed these miracles. What if the world was on the verge of realizing that this was truth and that this needed to be accepted? What if the world was on the verge of exploring whether or not what the Jewish people were saying was really true? If seas could split and the mighty empire of Egypt could be destroyed, then maybe we should listen to the Jewish people. What if the world was on the verge of creating a world of harmony, of ethics? And then Amalek came along. And Amalek attacked the Jewish people and showed that the Jewish people could be attacked. So it wasn't just a question of what Amalek did to the Jewish people. Amalek changed the destiny of world history because the world saw that the Jewish people could be attacked from behind. That's one way of looking at it, right? What interests me, however, is velo yare elokim, and not fearful, not aware of God. Now, who does that refer to? So one opinion is that that refers to the Jewish people, that the reason that Amalek has the ability to come along is because our relationship with God is weakened. If we truly had a deep relationship with God, and everything that that means, right, in terms of ethics, in terms of mitzvot, in terms of our understanding what we have to give to the world, in terms of being vehicles for making a better world, then Amalek would have no place to come to. However, if we lose that, then Amalek finds the place, finds the space. There is, however, another way to understand that, and that is that it's not that the Jewish people were lo yare elokim, the Jewish people were not fearful or in awe of God, but rather Amalek. That the definition of Amalek is that they are lo yare elokim, right? That's the essence of who they were. That's why they're so terrible, right? So, on the one hand, right, I want to understand that term. Why is that so important, that they are lo yare elokim, right? It's interesting, it seems like a simple story. I mean, 3,000 years ago, we were leaving Egypt, fresh from the miracle of the splitting of the sea. And the Torah tells us that a nation came out of nowhere and attacked the Jewish people, and in response, Joshua, at Moshe's behest, leads the first makeshift Jewish army into battle. And the Amalekites are actually vanquished in battle. Right? Seems like a simple story. One more battle, one more victory, one more stepping stone on the Jewish people's journey to freedom. Yet for some reason, God seems to take this one a lot more personally. In Shemot, in the book of Exodus, which is where we read about it actually happening, as opposed to this week's portion where it recalls it's happening to the second generation about to enter the land of Israel, it says, "Macho emched zecher Amalek mitachat hashamayim." God says, "I will erase the memory of Amalek." And further, Moshe, in building an altar to God to commemorate the victory, says, "Ki yad al keska milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek midor do." For by the oath of God on his throne, God will wage war on Amalek forever, right, from generation to generation. And, Rashi, many of the commentaries point out that the word case, which is the throne of God, as in the word kiseh, is missing a letter. It's missing the letter Aleph, because the throne of God is incomplete. God is incomplete in this world, as it were, because Amalek exists. Right? And in the interest, it's interesting to note that in the original battle in Exodus, it's God who plans on waging war with and blotting out the memory of Amalek. But in our portion here in Dvarim, 40 years later, it's the Jewish people that are commanded to do this. Now, this could simply point to the partnership we have with God, that we have to do our bit and God has to do his bit, right? But it's interesting that there may be something deeper here, because in our book of Dvarim this week, Hashem is speaking to the second generation. And the Torah is much more concerned about what it is that the second generation will do, right? And there's a lot to talk about. However, none of this seems to help us with our original question. What is it about this event that warrants such a severe response as the destruction of an entire people? Is it because the suddenness of their appearance on the scene seems to suggest that they had no reason to attack us? Right? The Torah doesn't offer any explanation as to why the Amalekites were so bent on the destruction of the Jewish people, but neither does it really offer an explanation as to why it is that we have to destroy this nation. Right? Even if you say that this attack stemmed from pure hatred, one wonders at the intensity of a hatred that can survive 300 years without any contact. I mean, if you say that this stemmed from the fact that Amalek was the grandson of Esav, and that Amalek was brought up on the hatred of his grandfather for Yaakov, because Yaakov steals the birthright from Esav, that would mean that an entire people is still consumed by this hatred for the Jewish people 300 years later, even though they've had no contact probably with the Jewish people because the Jewish people were slaves in Egypt. You could say that it's the heinous nature of the original crime, attacking us from the rear, killing our women and children, because after all, who are the weak that traveled in the rear back then? Right? Not necessarily today. Yet we are not enjoined to erase the memory of the Babylonians or the Romans, who certainly perpetrated tremendous crimes against us. So the truth is that, like I said before, there's one phrase that may offer a key, and that's the phrase "V'lo yirei Elokim." They did not fear God. Now, this is a phrase that at first glance seems a little bit out of place. I mean, if Amalek attacked the Jewish people immediately after splitting of the sea, it goes without saying that they did not fear God. Because if they really feared God, obviously they wouldn't attack. In fact, the Torah makes the point of telling us that unlike Amalek, the rest of the Canaanite nations were in fact filled with dread after hearing of the miracles of the Jewish people exodus from Egypt, right? Namogu kol yoshvei Canaan. All the settlers of Canaan trembled. 40 years later, when Joshua enters the land and meets Rachav, or the two spies meet Rachav, she testifies 40 years later that the Canaanites are still terrified of the Jewish people. And further, so I can understand that, you know, obviously if Amalek would attack the Jewish people, they don't fear God. Why do I need that in the verse? And beyond that, I mean, this facet of the Amalekite mindset would seem to be less severe than the fact that they actually attacked us from the rear. And yet it is in fact mentioned as if to imply that this was an even greater reason for the importance of eradicating all the memory of Amalek, because it's mentioned last. Right? So it's interesting. The phrase, V'lo yirei Elokim, is one that does not appear all that often in the Torah. And it seems to have a very specific meaning. The best example of this is Avram's explanation to Avimelech. When Avram goes down to the land of the Philistines because there is a famine in the land, right? So he ends up in Gerar, which is a Philistine city, and he pretends that Sarah and his sister is his sister, not his wife. And eventually Avimelech finds out, because God comes to him in a dream and tells him, and he gets upset with Avram. Why did you tell me she was your sister? We could have committed a terrible sin and taken a woman who was married. And Avram explains, Ki amarti, because I said, Rak ein yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh, v'haraguni al dvar ishti. But I said, surely there is no fear of God in this place, no awe of God, and they will kill me for my wife's sake. Right? That's in Bereshit in the 20th chapter of Genesis. In other words, the definition of a place where there is no fear of God, in this instance, is that such people would kill a man without a second thought just to take his wife. In fact, the Sfarno here goes so far as to say, the Sfarno was an Italian commentator from the 15th century, that he says it doesn't even have to mean fear of God, but just fear of the law. In fact, the word Elokim, right, V'lo yirei Elokim, and they were not fearful of God, can also mean a judge. Elokim is the word for judge in the Torah, and therefore it may be not that that Avimelech, in the case of Avraham, you know, that this was a place where they didn't fear God, but it was a place without Yirat Elokim. It was a lawless place. There was no fear of the law. The life of a man was worth less than the value of a cheap thrill. And, you know, it's interesting, by the way, that one of the 7 Noahide laws, the result of the flood, is that in order that the world shouldn't be destroyed, that a city shouldn't be destroyed, or in this case, that a nation shouldn't be destroyed, there must be 7 laws, and one of them is the creation of a system of courts and judges. So a place that has no Yirat Elokim has no fear of the law. Joseph, by the way, when he's speaking to his brothers, under the guise of being the viceroy of Egypt, right, when they still don't know who he is, tells them that he will not kill them without cause, right, giving them a chance to prove that they are, perhaps, as they claim, not spies, because et Elokim ani yarei, right, that's in the 42nd chapter of Bereshit, because I fear God. So fear of God means that you will not kill someone, and that you will uphold the law. And the midwives, by the way, the mialdot, who were commanded by Pharaoh in Shemot in the first chapter of Exodus, and they were commanded to kill every Jewish baby or every Jewish baby boy, simply could not perform this unspeakable crime again, because vatira'ena hamialdot et Elokim, because the midwives feared God. So maybe this is the meaning, or could be the meaning, behind this mitzvah to eradicate an entire people. What does it mean to be able to take the life of a fellow human being without hesitation and for no apparent cause? What's the nature, in fact, of any random, thoughtless, and especially cruel act? Right? Essentially, if you can hurt your fellow human being, it means that you don't see the spark of God inside of him. It means that you don't recognize there's something missing in your perception of God in the world. Right? Perhaps if Hashem, you know, I'll give you a great example. Rav Menachem Mendel of Kutsk. remember once reading that when he was in his period of wanderings, he took tremendous care to never step on an insect, even when he was walking. So I always thought that this was just a way of training himself to be sensitive. After all, if you could learn to care deeply for an ant, then you'd have a harder time ever being callous and uncaring to your fellow human being. But the truth is, it may go much deeper than that. If Hashem in his wisdom saw fit to spend thousands of years developing nature in the world to the point where this particular ant would live to cross my path, then how could I callously destroy it without a moment's thought? I mean, if I really knew that God runs the world, and I really believed that Hashem created this particular ant, then I could never wantonly destroy it. Which means that my ability to do just that would be a sure sign that there is a little bit of God missing in my life. In fact, Yirat Elokim, and we've spoken about this before, does not really mean fear of God. The word Yirah actually means, or stems from the same root as Lirot, to see. Yirat Hashem is really to see God, to be so aware of God, to see God everywhere and in anything, and in everything, that it actually changes who I am and how I see the world. Right? Torah doesn't tell me where to find God. The only place the Torah actually mentions that God is that every human being is created in the image of God. Which means that there's a little bit of God in every human being. Right? Which of course is why, as Rav Kook suggests, the root of any and all unethical behavior stems from the nature, or the lack thereof, of one's relationship with and perception of God. Meet someone who puts on tefillin every day, studies the Talmud every day, right? Wears tzitzis down to his knees, but could be rude to someone, and such a person, with all those mitzvot under his belt, still being able to be rude to someone, it would mean that there was something missing, at least in that moment, from their relationship with God. And this, of course, brings us back to Amalek. Can a society reach such a low level and become so immersed in evil that they no longer have the possibility of contributing to building a better world? Can a culture sink to the point where the price the world pays for their existence is too great? By the way, just to be clear, this is God's decision, not ours. You know, and how we know what God's decision is, that's an interesting question. But at the very least, to make that point. When one people so hates another, and so despises their desire to create an ethical world, that they will nurse a blind hatred for the better part of 300 years, and attack against all logic and beyond all reason, then something is seriously wrong. When the life of a fellow human being, however different, becomes so worthless as to be of no value, worth less than the expended energy necessary to swing a sword, then maybe that people has so lost touch with what we are here for in this world as to no longer have the right to hold peace, morality, and a better world from arriving. The closest example, of course, that our generation can relate to is Nazi Germany. I mean, Hitler made quite clear in Mein Kampf why he was so bent on the destruction of the Jewish people. He could never forgive us for introducing to the world the concept of an objective right and wrong. With one God as a higher moral ethic, Hitler believed in the concept of natural evolution, survival of the fittest, and the idea that might makes right. And as such, he, and along with him an entire German society, hated us for no other reason than for who we are. Perhaps there are moments in history where society, as in the case of Noah's flood, sinks to such a level that the world needs to let go of them and move on. And maybe that's why the Torah describes Amalek's attack here as being when you left Egypt, instead of as when we were on our way to Israel. I mean, it really should say that we were on our way to Israel. We'd already left Egypt. But the creation of the Jewish people was all about trying to leave Egypt and the evil that it represented behind. And yet Amalek refused to let that horrible nightmare die. And worse, while Egypt represented a particular generation that had become so evil as to warrant its destruction, Amalek represented the inculcation and indoctrination of this evil to such an extent that even the children were born into it. Much like the Hitler Youth of 60 years ago. It would be so easy to view this story of Amalek as a piece of history long since faded into the collective memory of an ancient people. But the Torah tells us that this is just not so. 3,000 years later, we are warned to take heed and to not forget the terrible lessons of pure raw hatred that almost saw the entire Jewish people destroyed again in Persia, because Haman was a direct descendant of Amalek, and again 60 years in Germany. Now, Soloveitchik believed, and he wrote an article about this, that Nazi Germany was the modern-day reincarnation, as it were, of Amalek. And make no mistake about it, as long as schools can teach hatred in textbooks, and little children can learn to idolize suicide bombers and sing nursery rhymes of rolling bloody Jewish heads in the streets, we still have a long way to go. And in the meantime, while we do our best to recognize where this evil lies and how easily it can rear its ugly head if we don't take great care, we would do well to consider one last point. Sometimes the most dangerous form of Amalek is the one that we carry inside ourselves. Whenever we feel enmity towards our fellow human beings simply because they're different, or we allow hatred to well within us towards others simply because their point of view differs from ours, then Amalek is alive and well right inside our own synagogues and homes and communities. Which of course goes a long way towards explaining why we are reminded of this story every year just before Rosh Hashanah. Maybe this year we will finally find the strength to put aside our differences, to find ways to work together towards the incredible dreams and noble goals that we all share. And then maybe Amalek will appear, or rather I should say disappear, all on their own.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.